Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Employer Extortion Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On June 26, 2013, the Supreme Court announced its decision in Sekar v. United States. The question in this case is whether attempting to compel a person to recommend that his employer approve an investment constitutes the obtaining of property from another for purposes of an extortion conviction under the Hobbs Act. In an opinion delivered by Justice Scalia, the court held unanimously that such activity does not constitute the obtaining of property from another necessary for an extortion conviction under the Hobbs Act. The decision of the United States Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit affirming the defendant's conviction was therefore reversed. Chief Justice Roberts, as well as Justices Thomas, Ginsburg, Breyer, and Kagan, joined the opinion of the court. Justice Alito filed an opinion concurring in the judgment, which was joined by Justices Kennedy and Sotomayor. To discuss the case, we have Ilya Shapiro, who is a senior fellow in constitutional studies at the Cato Institute and editor-in-chief of the Cato Supreme Court Review. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Shapiro.
On the final day of term, the Supreme Court, in between its gay marriage cases, decided a case called Sekar versus United States, which will be of interest to a lot of the criminal justice bar and others who care about the overcriminalization of the law and people being charged willy-nilly by federal prosecutors. The case didn't get much press, not just because of it's being released on the same day as the same-sex marriage cases, but also because it turned out to be a unanimous and not so controversial at the Supreme Court decision. But the story of the case is far from simple. You have to go back to 2009 when the general counsel of the New York Comptroller's Office, which of course is in the news now because Eliot Spitzer is running for New York Comptroller. Anyway, the counsel of the Comptroller's Office, acting as the sole trustee of the state's employee pension fund, recommended against investing in a fund managed by a company called FA Technology Ventures. Shortly after, this general counsel received a series of anonymous emails from what turned out to be the petitioner in this case, Jiridhar Sekar, who's the managing partner at this FA Technology Ventures. And these emails demanded that the general counsel either recommend the fund for investment by New York or to have allegations of an extramarital affair exposed to the public. Not a very nice enterprise. Mr. Sekar ended up being indicted in federal court and charged with violating the Hobbs Act, which you might know punishes extortion, one of the oldest crimes in our legal tradition. But not just extortion, not common law extortion. It was a law passed in 1946 mainly to deal with mobsters who were getting payments and other valuable property by threatening the use of force. So more specifically, the Hobbs Act prohibits extortion affecting interstate commerce, which means conduct including, quote, attempts to obtain property from another induced by wrongful use of fear and threatened fear. So the critical issues here were whether the general counsel's right to make a recommendation to approve or not approve the fund constituted property within the meaning of the Hobbs Act, and whether Mr. Sekar's conduct was an attempt to obtain that property. Now, in 2003, 10 years ago, in a relatively well-known Supreme Court case called Scheidler versus the National Organization for Women, which involved attempts to use the Hobbs Act against a plot to shut down abortion clinics, the Supreme Court appeared to have narrowed the scope of the Hobbs Act. This was a unanimous ruling saying that simply threats of violence weren't enough. You had to have some sort of transfer of property, things like that. The district court instructed the jury, however, that property includes, quote, any valuable intangible right considered as a source or element of wealth, and so Mr. Sekar was convicted. And then the appeals court, the Second Circuit, affirmed that holding, finding that the general counsel had a property right in, quote, rendering sound legal advice to the comptroller, and that Sekar had attempted to deprive the general counsel of that property right with his scheme by threatening to expose this affair. Now, this, I think, and the court unanimously ended up agreeing, contravenes the Supreme Court's principles of statutory interpretation and substantive jurisprudence. And indeed, Mr. Sekar argued first a number of things. First of all, the rule of lenity, that the Hobbs Act was ambiguous and it wasn't clear whether this type of property or not property was affected, and therefore the court should err on the side of not federalizing these sorts of crimes. It also says that argued that the court should look closely at what the retirement funds counsel actually did. There was nothing transferred to anyone else, and there was nothing transferred to Mr. Sekar. Once delivered, a piece of legal advice doesn't become the property of someone else or anything like that. So it's kind of an inapt application of the brief. The federal government, on the other hand, argued that the Hobbs Act extends to, quote, intangible rights with economic value, noting that the federal law, the Hobbs Act, was modeled on New York State's extortion law, and that law has long been interpreted to cover property beyond tangible articles. When one interferes with someone else's, quote, right to pursue one's existing business or occupation free from improper interference, that constitutes a violation of the Hobbs Act, the government argued. And I should disclose or note that Cato filed a brief that I signed along with the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. We were the only amicus brief that was filed, urging the Supreme Court to resolve this perpetual issue that arises whenever Congress enacts a statute and prosecutors stretch the meaning of the statute's language to conduct that Congress never intended to punish, and expanding, therefore, federal prosecutorial powers. So even if the underlying behavior was not nice or even criminal in some other way, if the statutory language doesn't quite fit, then courts shouldn't take liberties to expand federal power in that way. I mean, this reminded me of when I was clerking in the Fifth Circuit about 10 years ago, and we would have a lot of cases involving mail and wire fraud. And a lot of times, my judge, a Republican appointee, not some bleeding heart liberal or what have you, would rule to vacate the conviction because simply the elements of use of the mails or wire fraud or what have you, there wasn't enough of a federal connection. And this is a similar type case. And indeed, at oral argument here, Mr. Sekar was certainly helped by having Paul Clement as his advocate. He did a masterful job of showing why exactly honing in on this issue of the recommendation, the lawyer's recommendation, the lawyer's legal advice can in no way be construed as this sort of property to be extorted and thus subjecting the petitioner, Mr. Sekar, to the Hobbs Act prosecution. When the government's lawyer, the assistant to the Solicitor General, came up to argue, Justice Kennedy spun a hypothetical involving a stenographer typing up a letter about a lawyer's recommendation and was instructed by the lawyer to type no to the particular request, but somebody threatened her and had her type yes. Was this something that, you know, came under the jurisdiction of the Hobbs Act? And Justice Breyer continued, from that, it seemed like Justice Scalia, you know, said that when the government tried to explain that the extortionist was taking control of the property of the lawyer by his job of giving advice and things like this, Justice Scalia said, I don't know what that means. You're just throwing words around. An interesting point on rebuttal, Justice Sotomayor concerned that perhaps if the petitioner's arguments were taken to their logical extreme, that would undermine, in particular, a Second Circuit ruling that supported the government's authority to go after mobsters, in one case finding extortion in a gangster's attempt to use a threat of force to take over someone else's business. Paul Clement said that he knew of this case, but suggested that it didn't have that much precedential value. It wasn't Marbury, in part because it was a federal trial judge, a district judge sitting by designation that wrote it, to which Justice Sotomayor, having been a district judge sitting by designation, didn't take too kindly. But anyway, Clement smoothed over that bump. And in the end, as I said, the Supreme Court ruled unanimously, although in a couple of separate opinions, against the government's position, reversing the conviction. Scalia wrote for six justices saying what was charged in this case was not extortion, whether viewed under the common law, the text and genesis of the statute, or the court's prior cases. While extortion is, quote, one of the oldest crimes in our legal tradition, it originally applied only to extortionate action by public officials and did not cover mere extortion, a mere coercion to act. The defendant had to, quote, obtain items of value. So, for example, when Congress modeled the Hobbs Act on New York's extortion statute, it did not adopt the separate New York crime of coercion. Quote, interference with rights was clearly coercion, not extortion, and that's why Shidler, that abortion clinic case from 2003, held that extortion, quote, requires not only the deprivation, but also the acquisition of property. Thus, and I think this is the most important part of the holding, quote, the property extorted must therefore be transferable. The government's attempts to distinguish Shidler is, quote, nonsensical, according to Scalia, writing for six justices. There's no distinction between coercing someone to do something versus coercing them to do nothing, and neither is extortion. This case is easier than Shidler, Scalia says, where the defendants did at least occupy the physical property of the victims. Even if the general counsel's right to make a recommendation could be called, quote, property in a broad sense, it, quote, certainly was not obtainable property under the Hobbs Act. And then Justice Alito concurred in the judgment, joined by Justices Kennedy and Sotomayor, to say that the definition of property at common law and when Congress adopted the Hobbs Act encompassed anything of value, but plainly does not reach everything that a person may hold dear. A mere internal recommendation that a state government take an initial step that might lead eventually to investment simply, quote, stretches the concept of property beyond the breaking point. Now, Justice Scalia said that didn't want to rule out that the property had to be tangible. He focused on the fact that it had to be transferable and could envision scenarios where a lawyer's recommendation could be property, but not for purposes of the Hobbs Act. And footnote 5 of Scalia's opinion for the majority is what distinguishes his opinion from the concurrence. And in any event, the rule of lenity, they both agreed, counsels in favor of the judgment today, even if the Hobbs Act were ambiguous. So that's about it. The either federal or state prosecutors, I'm sure, have enough material to charge Mr. Sekar with something, although there are now, of course, double jeopardy considerations. But the Supreme Court, and I think ultimately, you know, I'm a little biased in that I filed a brief supporting this position, found that the Hobbs Act can't be read to reach something other than the use of force to effect the transfer of a certain type of property, which a lawyer's recommendation is not.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.